Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us is a great favorite here, Jesse McKinley, Albany Bureau Chief of the New York Times, and it doesn't get any more prestigious or good than that. Welcome back, Jesse.
Hi, Alan. Good to hear from you.
And it's good to have you here. I guess the main thing everybody's going to want to hear about this week is the relationship between the press and the sitting governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo. There is the nursing home death count controversy. You've been covering this since the beginning. Jesse, tell us what happened and bring us up to the latest news this week.
Well, it has not been a slow news week, let's put it that way. Basically, the most recent turn of affairs dates back about 3 weeks to the release of a report by Tish James, the state attorney general, which accused the Cuomo administration of greatly undercounting the number of deaths of nursing home residents. The estimate by the attorney general was an undercount of about 50%. That prompted the Cuomo administration to actually update its numbers almost 6 hours later, and showing about a 45% increase, and thereby proving Tish James correct. So that set off kind of a flurry of interest in the nursing home issue, which, of course, you know, has been dogging the governor since the beginning of the pandemic, but has really heated up in the last couple of weeks. And then last week, the New York Post got its hands on a private recording of a conversation between Melissa DeRosa, the secretary to the governor, and one of the governor's closest aides, basically saying that they had neglected to give data to state lawmakers purposely because they were worried about a potential federal investigation from the Trump administration. Now, the Cuomo administration had said that they were worried that this was politically motivated, and considering the relationship between the Cuomo administration and the Trump White House, that is not a completely uncredible line of thinking. But the withholding of data from lawmakers and by extension the public struck many people as unjust and potentially even criminal, which has led to this week's developments, which include not only the New York State Senate considering stripping the emergency powers from Governor Cuomo, but also what seems to be the kind of early stages of a federal investigation out of the FBI and U.S. District Attorney's Office in Brooklyn, looking into whether there was any malfeasance vis-a-vis this data, its withholding, or any other issues. So there has been a lot going on in Albany, to say the least.
How much of this do you think, Jesse McKinley, is due to the fact that Cuomo is a bit bossy, a bit difficult, and that there are plenty of people with sharp knives out ready to get him?
Well, I actually neglected one other element of the story, which broke on Wednesday, which was a conversation between the governor and Ron Kim, a Queens Assemblyman, which apparently got quite heated and involved Mr. Kim accusing the governor of basically saying that the governor would destroy him and destroy his reputation. Which the governor denied, but then almost simultaneously held a press conference where he basically went out and called Ron Kim, you know, corrupt and said that he was potentially borderline criminal in relationship to something that happened 6 years ago vis-a-vis a bill to regulate nail salons. So that behavior, the governor's kind of taking down of a lawmaker in a news conference, kind of speaks to the question that you asked and whether or not the governor's kind of somewhat, let's say, brusque style sometimes has gotten him in trouble with not only lawmakers, but with, you know, the public and with people that have, you know, lauded him by and large for his coronavirus, handling. And that is where we're at this moment, right? Where you've got a governor who was kind of celebrated as the COVID hero for months and months and months, and now over the course of the last month has seen that reputation tarnished, to be sure.
And don't forget about the press. The press has taken great interest in this thing. It's reached international proportions. And the very fact that people choose one story or another, and that lots of press have chosen this story, is indicative of maybe some hostility between Cuomo and the press.
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily hostility, but it certainly it speaks to the governor's prominence. You know, Andrew Cuomo over the course of the last year has undoubtedly become a national political figure in a way that he certainly was not prior to that, you know, the daily press conferences throughout last spring and into the summer made him, you know, must-see viewing for a lot of people. His name recognition obviously went up. His poll numbers, as you well know, went through the roof. You know, he was in the 70s, I think, at one point, maybe even touched on 80. And so obviously he became a much bigger figure, not only in state politics, but also national politics. So when you've got a figure like that, people want to cover him and people want to hear about him. And that includes both good news and bad.
To what end? I mean, do you see any way at this stage of the game, with Kamala Harris being where she is as vice president and heir apparent or heiress apparent, that Cuomo could run for president?
Well, you know, as we've said, or as I've said to you before, I'm out of the political prognostication game. Most of my predictions are wrong, and those that aren't wrong are just dumb. So I'm not going to make any speculation. And then, of course, I'll make some speculation. I think that if Joe Biden does, in fact, decide not to run for a second term, which he's indicated in the past, I think it'll be a pretty wide open Democratic field in 2024. But to my point and your point before, certainly Andrew Cuomo is in a position or was in a position to potentially run for president. You know, he has three terms under his belt, almost three full terms as the governor of the fourth largest state. I think that he certainly has some big accomplishments to point to and a pretty promising record, despite the recent controversy over nursing homes. And certainly he has proved himself to be an avid fundraiser in years past and can certainly raise money, which, of course, is the unspoken or maybe completely spoken secret of running for president, is you got to raise $1 billion. You know, there's a lot of money it costs a lot of money to run for president. And so you have to prove yourself to be adept with donors. And obviously, Andrew Cuomo has proved himself to be able to raise money. So if you're checking boxes, those are boxes that would seem to indicate that this is a guy who could run for president. Now, I think the first things first, he will probably run for a fourth term next year in 2022. And I think the first thing he will probably have to confront is a primary for the Democratic nomination. Now, of course, you and I watched as Cynthia Nixon ran for the nomination in 2018. The governor spent an enormous amount of money, over $20 million, to defeat her and ended up defeating her pretty soundly. But I don't think that has put off the left wing of the Democratic Party, the progressive wing, from thinking that perhaps they might be able to primary him next year. And I think you'll see that. And just to finish my very long-winded thought, I would say that this controversy over nursing homes, which, you know, touches on some character flaws which have been written about Andrew Cuomo in the past, which are, you know, his tendency towards being heavy-handed, his tendency to not always be completely transparent, his tendency to shout people down that disagree with him. I think all of those elements will be a part of any campaign in a Democratic primary next year.
Well, I have referred to him as Tough Guy Andrew, and I think that that's what you're referring to just now. I want to ask you a question about the emergency powers issue. This whole thing was handed to Andrew by the Democrats in both houses. They gave him emergency powers. Now some of them are saying, time to take them back. And I know what my feelings are about that, but I'd rather hear from you. Go ahead.
Well, I think the Senate had been mulling this even before the recent controversy over nursing homes. In fact, I know they were. And I think it had been bubbling to a lesser degree in the state assembly, but the Senate had been kind of kicking this around. But let's be clear, the revelations regarding nursing homes, the outcry, the outrage in many quarters about this, particularly the element of the governor withholding data from state lawmakers, gave this idea new momentum. And now the state Senate is poised to pass a bill that would basically revoke the unilateral use of those powers by the governor and set up a 10-person commission in order to kind of evaluate future directives from the second floor, from the executive chamber. We'll see if the assembly follows suit on that. As I said before, they have not been as hot on this idea as the Senate has. But I think there are a lot of lawmakers in Albany who are not happy with the way the governor and his administration handled the data and handled the lawmakers and were not forthcoming with them about the scope of the problems that people were facing in nursing homes.
Now, Jesse, just for the sake of clarity, what were some of those emergency powers?
Well, it's everything from closing down businesses to setting up microcluster zones to setting capacity limits at restaurants and bars. You know, the bill that was passed last March granted additional powers to the governor. You know, governors have always had a certain amount of emergency power in case of flood or hurricane or earthquake, God forbid. And these basically expanded those into the realm of emerging disease outbreaks and gave him basically, a right to declare directives, which basically had the weight of law on a range of things. And he has used these repeatedly, not only to kind of set policy, but also to set aside state laws that might have, you know, kind of gummed up the works. And the argument for these is very clear. Look, we were facing a terrible pandemic, a pandemic that's killed 45,000 New Yorkers. And you needed to be nimble and you needed to be able to make these decisions without these sometimes languorous deliberative processes that you find in a legislature. So I think that there was great support for these at the time that they were passed. I think that, you know, Andrea Stewart Cousins said in a statement that we published last night that basically, you know, we're in a different place now than we were in last March. And that the legislature needs to basically reassert itself as a check and a balance to the executive chamber. And Gustavo Rivera, who's the chairman of the Health Committee in the Senate, echoed that, basically saying, look, you know, there are three branches of government here. It's not just the executive, like the legislative and to an extent the judicial, of course, have to have their say on these things. And I think that for many lawmakers, the time has come for the legislature to kind of step back up and get involved.
You know, Jesse McKinley, I have no doubt that you're right about that, except that as a political scientist, I've studied this over the years. And every time you put up a governor versus the legislature, the people put their fingers over their noses and go, pee you. So it's not exactly that we all suspect that they want it for the right reasons as opposed to the wrong reasons so they can get the pause on power. Now, interestingly, I think, look, they were, as you have just said, they were all too anxious to give it to the governor when he wanted it in the beginning. And I suspect was they didn't want to get sick and they wanted to stay home. And now I smell a little bit of hypocrisy here. What say you?
Well, you know, I think that the legislature has certainly given the governor carte blanche to run the pandemic, as it were. And I think the governor, going back to our original points early on, I think got very good reviews early on for being, you know, strong and making quick decisions on some things and more deliberative decisions on other things. And yet, you know, we have now moved into a different stage, you know, where the concentration is on vaccination. Certainly, there is still a terrible, terrible death toll every day. Still, people are getting sick. Still, we are very worried about, new variants, whether they be UK or South African or what have you. But I think there is a growing sense amongst lawmakers that we've moved to a different stage and they feel that they want to get more involved in the decision-making process here. And I don't think that there is a coincidence that this is coming at a time in which the governor has been, I don't know if technically weakened is the best word, but has certainly been, beaten up over the last couple of weeks over his handling of a central element of the coronavirus response, which was the treatment of people in nursing homes and the death toll there.
Jesse, I want to go back to our original question about this because it's so universal now. The press is all taking it. It's around the country, around the world. So is this whole thing about the nursing homes overblown? I mean, the death numbers are accurate. They did not undercount the number who died, just the label of where they died. We're reading that other states have delayed reporting their data about nursing home deaths as well. And, for example, the Washington Post has done a terrific job about that. I hate to say that to a New York Times guy. But, you know, is it overblown?
Well, let me just say that I love the Washington Post. So let's put that to rest first and foremost.
Absolutely.
The issue here, Ellen, though, is not the overall death toll. That has never been in question. And the governor has said, look, we counted all the deaths. But to go back, the issue here is whether or not people who were living in nursing homes or long-term care facilities, whether that cohort of people was being counted, those deaths were being counted accurately. And keep in mind that in late January, the state of New York was basically saying that the death toll of those residents was about 8,500, 8,700 people. After Tish James's report came out, that number suddenly shot up through a release of data from the State Department of Health to almost 13,000. Now, with additional updates, it's up to almost 15,000. So in terms of nursing home residents and long-term care facility residents, that number has gone from, let's say, 8,500 to 15,000. That is almost double. And once again, this is not just data for data's sake, right? People were and continue to make decisions about their loved ones, about people that were going into these facilities, in part because of information like this, which told them whether or not these facilities were safe. So if you are hearing that 8,500 people have died in these facilities versus 15,000, that may have influenced your thinking about whether or not to put your loved one, someone that you care about, into one of these facilities, because it speaks to whether or not those facilities were safe. So leaving aside the data, which can get confusing and can kind of, you know, confuse people, that is at the heart of it, whether or not the public was being given accurate information to make informed decisions about people that they love.
He wrote a book about this. Some people, including me, thought it might have been a little bit of a premature victory lap. What do you think?
I think that the book has certainly become a point of criticism. You know, I think that there are a lot of people out there that share your viewpoint that it was premature. And certainly in watching Twitter, which can also be, you know, informative of where people's, you know, hearts and fears and hatreds are, the book gets a lot of vitriol, certainly from right-wing sites that don't like him in general, but from, you know, other just kind of common Twitter folks who find that the book may have set kind of a mission accomplished banner over a crisis that was ongoing. And once again, to go back to data without boring you, since that book came out on October 13th, I think the last count was somewhere in the neighborhood of 9 or 10,000 New Yorkers have died. So once again, that juxtaposition of a book that the governor was paid to write coming out and then an additional toll of people dying, I think that strikes many people as wrong. Now, we'll see where it all ends up. We still don't know what exactly the governor was paid to write the book. We have heard that he will give some of that money to charity or to groups that are fighting the disease. We still don't have details on that. But come April 15th, when his tax return is released, we should know how much he was paid for that. And I don't think the book issue will go away anytime soon.
Okay, let's talk about the budget deficit. How much is New York in the hole at this stage?
More money than you or I have, Alan. That is for sure. It is somewhat of a moving target because, you know, obviously taxes are being paid and the coffers are filling. And there are estimates that run anywhere from, you know, the $7 to $8 billion to $15 billion, which is what the governor says the state needs in order to fill its hole. Now, the X factor in all of this, of course, will be whether or not the Biden administration is able to secure, you know, enough money for states. The governor has asked for $15 billion in direct aid, and it seems as though at last report that the number that Chuck Schumer and the Senate will be able to deliver will be close to that, like somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 to $13 billion. So I think in terms of budget disasters, I think perhaps New York has averted that, but obviously there's still a lot of moving pieces. And, you know, we are now in budget season here in Albany, and I think that that is going to be a certain amount of, there's going to be a lot of hard conversations about spending, you know, how much money can actually go out the door if, you know, we're still looking at the lingering and lasting impact from coronavirus. You know, the impact on, you know, particularly hospitality industries, restaurants, bars, hotels, particularly in New York City, is still a huge hole. Broadway is still shut down. Tourism is off by, you know, almost completely off the, you know, previous highs. So there are long-term problems that the state and city and localities are facing, and I think that the budget negotiations will probably reflect that.
Including the fact that taxes may, whether Cuomo likes it or not, may go up, because both leaders in both houses have, you know, certain proclivities to do that.
Yeah, no, there's absolutely talk amongst a lot of lawmakers that the taxes on the wealthy need to go up, that it's time for the wealthy to kind of pay their fair share. And I think just optically, you know, the fact that the Dow Jones average is now well over 30,000, which I think is well past what it was when the coronavirus crisis began.
Indeed.
You know, I think that for a lot of rank and file members, that looks unfair, right? That the people that are in the markets have actually made money or seen their stocks go up, while a lot of people have lost jobs, lost incomes, lost homes, lost, you know, rental units, et cetera. So I think that those sorts of just kind of, you know, visceral, the wealthy or got wealthy and the middle class and the lower middle class got, you know, ravaged by this. I think that sort of dynamic is going to give some momentum to raising taxes on the rich.
And there has always been that talk about that stock transference tax. And people like Cuomo worry that, you know, have worried out loud that the stock exchange could move from New York.
Yeah, no, I found it telling a couple of weeks ago that a number of those groups came out and, you know, basically put out a letter saying, you know, if you put the stock transfer tax back on the table, we're going to move out of town. I think they would only do that if they thought that there was a real possibility that that might be gaining traction in the state house.
I see. Okay. So now two Capital District Republicans have announced legislation to create a criminal penalty for violating New York's Freedom of Information law. State Senators Jim Todisco and Daphne Jordan are saying they are pushing the measure in response to controversy over the state's handling of information on COVID-19 deaths. Now, of course, Jesse McKinley of the New York Times, you ask the governor's administration all the time for information. Are you satisfied with what you're getting?
No, because I'm a reporter. And of course, reporters always want more information. We want all the information so we can inform the public. So are we satisfied? Certainly not with the level of information that comes out of the Cuomo administration. Although, you know, certainly the governor has made himself available to reporters over the course of the coronavirus crisis. I'll say hello to your dog. But, you know, the larger point is that, you know, the Freedom of Information Act in New York has not always been completely effective in prying information out of public agencies. You know, the Department of Health before the coronavirus crisis hit was kind of famously known as a slow agency to respond to FOIL requests. The governor's office has often resisted FOIL requests. The New York Times, we had to wage a court battle in order to get information about the Prococo convictions and emails that we were seeking in reference to that. So have they always been transparent? Have they always been forthcoming? No. So I think that's an ongoing source of frustration. And just to go back to the nursing homes for a second, I think that, you know, one of the sources of information we've received in the last couple of weeks came out of a FOIL request from the Empire Center, which was asking for nursing home data, which was being, they had to take the Department of Health to court in order to pry that information out. And now that that information is out, it has given us a fuller picture of the toll in those homes.
Tell me about the census, and we've talked about this before, and the gerrymander. Obviously, we're going to lose one congressional seat, maybe two. And where would you suspect that there may be some room, wiggle room here?
I think that there has been speculation that the Democrats will probably try to eliminate a Republican seat. Dave Wasserman, who is with the Cook Political Report, had been floating a concept a couple of weeks ago that basically would combine the Claudia Tenney district in Utica and the Lee Stefanik district into kind of a mega district of central and northern New York. Now, obviously, that was just speculation, but I think that there is some sense that, you know, the new lines could hurt Republicans who are already, you know, kind of, I believe there's only six Republicans in the delegation at this point. But with 27 seats that New York has right now, if that gets reduced to 26 or to 25, I think you could see some new lines drawn that Republicans would not be thrilled with.
Yeah, I bet that's true. Let me ask you this, Jesse McKinley. Would you be surprised if Attorney General Letitia James followed in the path of Andrew Cuomo and Elliot Spitzer and decided to run for governor? I mean, attorney generals in this state tend to do that.
Yeah, I think the old saying was what AG stands for, aspiring governor, right?
I always heard it was almost governor.
Almost governor, yeah, there you go. I think Tish James has probably a bright political future. I think, you know, she has, particularly vis-a-vis this nursing home thing, I think she really surprised a bunch of people that kind of thought that she would be beholden to Andrew Cuomo as a result of him supporting her in 2018. And I think that showed, or at least indicated, a degree of independence from the governor when that report came out in January. I think, obviously, she would have support in the city from where she served as public advocate. And I think that she could, make a credible case to run for governor. I don't, however, know that in 2022 that is necessarily the route for her. Although, as I said before, I think there probably will be a primary. But, you know, I think that primary might come from even a little further to the left. I could see someone like Jemani Williams running, who obviously ran with Cynthia Nixon for lieutenant governor in 2018, or a candidate to be named later. But I'm not completely convinced that Tish would run in 2022.
So the polling on her versus Cuomo is not very strong right now, but that's very early, right?
Yeah, right now, I think the state and probably the nation has a little bit of election fatigue in addition to COVID fatigue. You know, the presidential only just finished, I think, when Joe Biden got inaugurated. So I think a lot of people are still kind of shaking off the last election cycle. Yeah. But certainly, you know, we'll have the midterms next year. Governor Cuomo will probably face a primary and certainly face a general in November 2022 if, as assumed, he runs for a fourth term. And I think, you know, the question of whether or not the Republicans will field a credible gubernatorial candidate next year is an interesting one, too. There's been a lot of chatter that perhaps Elise Stefanik, the upstate congresswoman, would be interested in running for that. She hasn't said so, but, you know, I think Republicans would be thrilled by that considering her kind of fiery brand of pro-Trump campaigning. So we'll see. It's a ways off, but it gets late early, as they say, right?
We are out of time. Our guest has been the amazing Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Jesse, as always, we're in your debt. Thanks so much for joining us.
Of course, Ellen, anytime.